I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, Philip Schlechte joins us to talk about school reform. Phil is a longtime and passionate advocate for public education, and his latest book, Leading for Learning, challenges many of the basic assumptions of educators. We'll talk about how to break through the bureaucracy of the education system and turn schools into learning organizations. We'll also speak with Clay Shirky. He's the author of the book, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. The book is about the power of the internet to break through old bureaucracy and how online networking can create brand new ways of interacting in the real world. That's all on today's Smart City, with the latest news from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator, Walker Smith, coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest says the American education system has been stuck in a rut since the first Model T Fords came off the assembly line. Phil Schlechte is an author, an educator, and a school reform advocate, and his latest book is Leading for Learning, How to Transform Schools into Learning Organizations. Phil, you call for transformation of schools rather than school improvement or school reform. What does transformation mean to you?
Well, the picture I have in my head, when you think about reform, you're reforming an old system and making it look like the system, except it's being reformed. The model I use when I give speeches is a 1909 Ford truck Model T and a 2009 Ford truck are very alike fundamentally, even though they look a lot different. They've been reformed. A caterpillar is not a reformed worm. It's a transformed worm. It's a metamorphosis has taken place. It has a fundamentally different structure. It's different in kind rather than simply different in degree. And what I'm suggesting is that we need to have a different type of education system, not just a different form of schooling.
And you call specifically for schools to become learning organizations, to transform themselves into learning organizations. How does a learning organization differ from a school?
Well, schools are basically, most schools are organized on bureaucratic principles, principles of rational systems. And the basic a learning organization is much more fluid, much more flexible, give a lot more emphasis to direction and beliefs and meanings and values, a lot less emphasis to power and authority, that who's in charge of things is not as important as what they're in charge of, and you have a directional system. In fact, in an earlier book as well, I talk about six different systems: the directional system, the knowledge transmission system, the power and authority system, the boundary system. And I say that each one of these systems has effects. And in learning organizations, they put the emphasis on the direction, on the knowledge development and transmission system, and on recruitment and induction. In bureaucracies, you put the emphasis on power and authority and on boundaries and issues of social control.
How did our schools become bureaucracies? Was this inevitable?
I don't think it was inevitable, but I think what happened, particularly the high schools, emerged at about the same time that the industrial system created by Henry Ford emerged. And many educators, partly in quest to being particularly educational administrators and largely urban superintendents, were very fascinated with the prospect of having scientific management applied to the schools very much the way it was being applied to industry. And as a consequence, they began to adopt the models from business they thought would work in education. And many of those models were highly rational models that reflected very much what Max Weber referred to as bureaucracy. And so it became a system of control. It started out with the assumption that teachers really aren't too bright. So what we have to do is make sure that we have teacher-proof materials. Linda Darling Hammond has written a lot about this in an earlier book. I've written about it myself. A guy by the name of Callahan wrote a book called Education in the Cult of Efficiency, which he talked about the same thing. And that basically it grew out of this whole industrial model that emerged in America, in particular after the 1870s. And was amplified when Ford created the Ford Motor Plant.
Well, it seemed to work for at least some period of time. Would you agree with that?
It worked for some kids. It was designed on the basis of assumption of selecting and sorting. That you basically had four tracks. You had a track for kids who could learn a lot. We called that the college prep track. We had a general track for those kids who might not learn a bunch, but they do pretty well. They do all right. Then we had a track, we called it the vocational track, for those kids that we assumed couldn't learn anything academic, and we even had a dropout track. The very, very first course I taught, I started teaching in 58, so it's been a long time. And when I started teaching, one of the first courses I taught, we referred to in the teacher lounge as terminal civics. And what we meant by that was it was civics for students that we knew were going to terminate. My high school principal engaged in dropout counseling. He counseled kids to drop out because we had kids that we knew didn't fit the mold. And so the school never really worked for most kids. It worked for some kids. And people overlook the fact that as late as 1950, nearly half of all Americans didn't drop out of high school because they didn't drop in. They hadn't been in high school. And so we overlook those facts, and we talk about the terrible dropout rate we have, which is terrible in today's context.
Well, you've raised about 100 questions for me, but so let me begin with one of them. You probably don't remember this, but years ago I came to visit you when you were in Louisville.
Right, I still am.
So I've been following your work for years, and you've been promoting this idea of making engaging work for students the entire time I've known you. So explain what you mean by making engaging work for students, how it gets made, by whom, and what it is.
Let me distinguish first between marketing and sales. Marketers begin with the values that customers bring to the transaction. Marketing begins with a customer, and design begins with a customer. And you say, what are the values, the motives they bring to the transaction? And then you try to design a product that responds to those motives. Sales begins with the product and then tries to provide incentives for people to buy the product whether they want it or need it or not. And in many ways, our schools are designed to be sales organizations rather than marketing organizations. And so we give kids the work we've designed the way we want to design it, and then we try to bribe them and threaten them to do it. And we need to take a marketing approach and say, how do we design work? How do we figure out what the values that the kids bring to this transaction are? Now, once you've understood what those values and motives are, how do we design work that leads them to want to do that work, and how do we make sure that work, in order to do it, they've got to learn what we want them to learn, that our product is not the kid. Our product is the work we give the kids. And how do we design work that has those qualities, those attributes about it, that leads the students to want to do it, and then to say, Lord, in order to do this work, I've got to learn something. I'll give you an example. I have a little 7-year-old grandson, and we bought him a Wii. And that Wii has a thing called Magnificent Mario. To play Magnificent Mario, you simply have to be able to read. So all at once, my grandson has a motive to read. He wants to do something he can't do unless he can read. And it's much different than the motive of saying, I want to satisfy my teacher or satisfy my mama. It's something he really wants to do. And in order to do it, he's got to learn to read. And so he pesters me to death. He says, what's that word mean, Grandpa? What's that word mean? Because he now has a need to read.
And apparently this is, by the way, very widespread, that the use of digital tools and technologies are, in fact, motivating children to learn to read much earlier.
Yeah, and I think we have to understand that, you know, schools are not designed to take advantage of that. Schools are designed as teaching platforms rather than learning platforms. And so what happens is when we bring technology into the school, we bring it in, we have departments of instructional technology, but we don't have a department of learning technology. And the kids need to learn how to use the technology to learn, but we try to use it in order to teach. We kind of have a push environment. We push information out to the kids, but we don't create work that leads them to want to pull the information in. And they've got all kind of tools now to pull information. And they've got all kind of modes of instruction available to them, but the schools are still based on the notion that the teacher is the primary instructor and the student is the primary product of the school, and we work on the kids rather than working on the work we give the kids.
I completely buy your point. You've got a whole teaching corps out there and a whole administrative corps devoted to the old model. I mean, how do you begin even to help teachers think about how to make engaging work for students?
You have to first challenge the basic mental models that they bring to the thing. You have to start with the question, who are the students in your school? Are students teachers do not like the idea of the student as product. They don't like it ideologically. Yet many teachers behave as though they are products because the system is designed on the assumption that kids are products. And once you get teachers to begin to talk about that, teachers want to be treated as professionals. Yet the system is designed to treat teachers as sort of low-level, low-skill workers on an assembly line. And once teachers begin to recognize that, they say, hey, we got to think our way out of this. And the first thing we have to do is change our heads. And so trainers have to create something that psychologists call cognitive dissonance. You got to position them so that they can see what's going on. And quite often they don't really see what's going on until someone raises a question about their own experience. Teachers are dedicated, hardworking people. If all it took to make the schools better was bright people who were dedicated and hardworking, we'd have been there a long time ago. Well, the problem is that the way we think about the problem does not make it possible for teachers to do the things they need to do because they think their primary task is instructing kids. Their primary task is inventing work that makes that creates a condition where kids want to be instructed. And that's a very different problem.
Now, I can't believe that the reaction of some teachers would not be, you're putting the inmates in charge of the asylum.
That's the way they start until they hear it. I mean, because it does, initially it sounds that way, but you're not saying that at all. It's like, I'm a leader of an organization. I have to create a condition in which the people that work for me, any leader, has to get people to want to follow. And that means you have to create a context. Now, you can coerce people, but you also need to inspire people. You need to respond to their motives. And the same thing has to happen with kids. They got to find meaning in their work. If I do meaningless work, you know, there's nothing wrong, for example, with memorization. But if it's meaningless memorization, then what happens? You forget everything you memorized after it's over with. If it's meaningful memorization, think of all the things that kids memorize every day. They memorize all these pop songs with all these silly lyrics and nonsense lyrics, and they remember it, and they'll remember it when they're 50. You know, I remember songs I learned when I was a kid that I don't know why in the world I still remember them. And I don't remember an awful lot of the poems I was forced to memorize because my English teacher said, memorize this. And I did, but I can remember some things I memorized in school in a context that had meaning to me that I still remember them. Well, what we have to do is create meaningful context, and when kids want to do the work, they want to learn the things they need to know to do that work.
You spoke earlier about the selecting and sorting of traditional schools and traditional education into college prep, general, vocational, dropout. There clearly is a belief, even as you write in your book, despite the slogans, despite all the things we say, we don't really believe that all kids can achieve or learn at high levels. You believe they can.
I think that most kids can achieve excellence in some area of life. I really believe that. And I think democracy is predicated upon that assumption. I think what we've done is so truncated what we mean by school success that most kids can't succeed until they get out of school because we've only got a very narrow band of success. I mean, the student who does those academic things you need to do in order to get an A is the person who's a success. I often say to school board members, if I said to you, a successful student are those students who are in the top 10% of the class, most of you would not have been successful students. But that really is how we distribute success in school. We distribute it to the top learners. And in fact, some parents will say, the only way I know my child is succeeding is somebody else's child fails. It takes the bottom half to hold the top half up. If we had all children succeeding at the level that the top 10% of our kids are now succeeding, you know what would be the first, and they all started getting A's, you know what would be the first thing that newspapers would begin to say? We've lowered our standards because everybody's getting an A. Because we believe that kids have to fail in order for other kids to succeed. The only area we kind of honor that in a different way is athletics and sometimes in music. We'll have a very talented athlete that because they're a talented athlete, we'll give them special admission to the university. Well, that's saying there are other areas of success that are important. Well, there's a whole bunch of areas of success that are important, but you don't find it out until you get out of school.
But should those, I mean, again, you're challenging academic achievement as the goal of success, right? And so you're saying there are other ways. You mentioned an athlete, you mentioned a musician who can succeed differently, obviously succeeding, but not necessarily in an academic way.
They attain a taste for excellence. You know, if you really watch great schools, and there are some great schools in the country, you're going to find they have a lot of areas in which they're excellent. You know, the school is academically excellent, is also athletically excellent, is also has great bands and great orchestras and so forth. There's a few of those schools around. Now, there are schools that say, we'll pick out a special area to be excellent in, and everything else can go by the boards. But there are schools that say, what we promote here is excellence. Whatever you do, do your best. That's something my mama taught me when I was a little kid. She'd say, I don't care what you do, whatever you do, be the best at it you can be. You got an obligation to do your best. My first grade teacher would say, every day and every way we get better and better. She didn't say we read more and more, we read better and better. You got to have a culture that promotes excellence. And kids have to have an opportunity to pursue excellence. And if I can't pursue excellence and I see myself as losing, let me give you one illustration of the effects of bureaucracy. We know the kids who start to school younger than their peers are less likely to do well than those that start to school older than their peers. We've got research data to support that. So if you want to predict who's going to do well in the class, if you just rank them by age of starting, you're going to have more of the top kids in the class will be older. And why is that? Well, because maturation with little kids makes an awful difference. Being 5 years and 364 days old is very different than being 5 years and 1 day old. But what happens is that kid that's 5 years and 1 day old has to compete against the one that's 5 years, 364 days old. And the teacher doesn't distinguish between maturation and performance. And as a consequence, by the time that younger kid has learned anything, they've learned they can't do things and they can't compete. And the system causes that. There are ways that you could avoid that. But to do that, you'd have to violate tradition. You'd have to have non-graded schools. You'd have to have teachers that understand that kind of difference, and it had to be honored. You couldn't have the standardized. Everybody has to be on the same page at the same time, no matter how old you are. We'd have to give kids an opportunity to start to school. Maybe every 3 months we have an entering class. There's all kinds of things that have to happen. And we're not prepared to do that, so what we do is what factories are good at, which is batch processing. And so we batch process these kids, and we know by doing that we're going to lose some.
Well, I have always, always found your ideas very compelling. And yet, almost everything you say, Phil, flies in the face of the way we do things today. You've been promoting these ideas a long time. Have you found schools or school systems willing to adopt enough of your concepts, enough of your ideas, that it begins to make a difference?
We're beginning to see, it's just taken a long time, but we're beginning to see some places where if they've got the right leadership, you're beginning to see things really begin to move. Now, the real question is, will it have staying power? You got to go beyond the first superintendent, the first school board, and these things had to get embedded in school boards and superintendent's office. If it's just a schoolhouse, when that principal is gone and that few dedicated faculty is gone, the idea will be gone. So you really have to ask yourself, can you get school boards to embrace these things? Can you get superintendents to embrace these things? And when they hire the second superintendent from the one that introduced it, do they say to the second superintendent, we don't need a visionary superintendent. We need a superintendent who can lead by our vision. And our vision is a school and a school district where every child is provided engaging work every day. That's what we're about. And we want to do anything we can do to make sure that the quality of the work we provide to kids has those qualities and attributes about it that attracts kids to want to do the work and attracts them so much that they're willing to learn what they need to learn in order to do it. And we've got teachers who know how to design that work. Our teachers are designers of work. They're not just simply instructors. They're designers of work that we give kids.
So somebody hearing this interview, reading your book, Leading for Learning, How to Transform Schools into Learning Organizations, says to themselves, I really believe this. I think we need to make these changes. Where do they begin? And let's say it's not someone on a school board. It's a citizen concerned about the performance of schools and children.
Well, I guess, I'm not trying to sell books, by the way. I mean, I'm not a huckster. One place to start is start reading about it. That book I wrote was written for a reason. And if I were a citizen, I might get 8 or 10 other citizens and say, I heard this silly guy on the radio the other day, make a certain amount of sense, and I understand he's written the book. Let's get together and have a book study. And let's talk about whether he makes any sense or not. And that'll lead you to other things. You don't have to buy what I'm saying. But we've got to get the citizens and the communities involved in learning how to learn about schools, because what often happens is school leaders begin to drive in this direction, it challenges some basic assumptions about that people have, and they say, oh, we can't do that. We can't give up on X, Y, or Z because we've always had it that way. So we say we want a different kind of learning, but the same old schools. Well, you're not going to get the different kind of learning with the same old schools, and so you have to really believe that you need a different kind of school, and you got to have community leaders that believe that. And that means you got to invite the citizenry in. You know, David Matthews at the Kettering Foundation talks about building a public for public education. And I think that's something we haven't done. We've moved the schools increasingly out of public control and into government control. The government is, in a democracy, responds to the public. But quite often the government made up of bureaucracies and bureaucrats who the public has to hold accountable. And the schools are institutions that ought to belong to the public as well. But we've increasingly made the schools belong to the government rather than belong to the people. And there's a real difference. And I'm not an anti-government person, by the way. But what I'm arguing is that the people should own the schools, and they need to belong to the community. And then we have to have ways of making the community responsible. If you don't have a responsible and trustworthy community, you're not going to have quality schools. And so the schools have to be involved in community building. That's a big thrust in this new book that I wrote. It's about the relationship between schools and community and how schools no longer can simply serve a community. They got to sometimes invent communities to serve. One of the big problems that we have in many of the inner city schools is a breakdown of community around the schools. Well, the schools are going to have to be involved in community building as well as school improvement. In fact, I thought sometimes, what would happen if we began to say schools are a supplement to the education that the community and the family provides? Right now we think about the schools being supported by the family and the community. What if we thought about the schools supporting the family and the community, and that the primary source of education is the family and the community, and the schools supplement that, as opposed to the primary source of education is the school and the community and the family supplement it? That would stand us on its head and cause us to think differently, and that's what we have to do.
Phil, it is always such a pleasure to catch up with you and what you're thinking now. Thank you so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you.
Phil Schlechte is the author of many books, including Leading for Learning, How to Transform Schools into Learning Organizations. For the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development, we go to PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
Some are calling it unexpected, but to others, it's simply good news. Cities across the country are experiencing falling crime rates, according to a recent article from the Washington Post. And the figures are striking. New York City, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. are on their way to recording their fewest homicides in at least 40 years. Figures are also down in cities like San Francisco, Boston, and Minneapolis. The downturn has caught some criminology experts off guard, leaving them scrambling for reasons why. During this recession, many are quick to try to relate the decrease to the struggling economy, but experts say the connection's just not there. Whatever the reason, crime enforcement officials in these cities are happy to take the credit. Meanwhile, in El Paso, Texas, city officials are trying to put a stop to outdoor advertising. The El Paso Times reports on recent moves in the city council to ban all new billboard construction in the city and place new controls over digital signs. Officials there want to join up with more than 350 other Texas cities that have banned new billboard construction. But the idea is taking a lot of flack. Some within the city argue the billboards are a good source of revenue for the city, especially during these tough times. Business people in town also argue that the tighter rules will hurt small businesses who count on billboards to reach their customers. The controversial move to ban the billboards was passed by the council, but Mayor John Cook promptly vetoed it. The city council will meet next week to consider an override of the mayor's veto. And finally, in the posh beachside community of Santa Monica, California, one small street has gotten a complete makeover. But it's not new benches or fancy landscaping that's changing the face of the street. It's work below the surface. The city just opened its first green street, equipped with permeable pavement, infiltration basins, and filtered gutters that prevent rainwater and urban runoff from carrying pollutants into the nearby Pacific Ocean. A recent story from The Lookout takes a tour of this new green street, which soaks up most of the water that hits it before it can get to the gutter. Because most of the stormwater system drains into the ocean, stopping pollutants from entering the system is the best way to prevent them from contaminating the sea. These permeable techniques and filtration devices are seen as the future of stormwater management in Santa Monica, and a possible model for streets throughout the country. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. Coming up next on Smart City, we'll speak with Clay Shirky. He'll be sharing his insights about online networking and how social media caused a rebirth of social capital. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Clay Shirky is a professor of New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program and the author of one of my favorite books, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. The book explores the way blogs, wikis, and all of the tools of the digital age help to form new groups of people. These large, self-organizing groups meet and mingle and may even change the way governments work. As you write in your first chapter, Clay, forming groups has gotten a lot easier. It sounds so simple, but you say there are big implications. Describe those.
The change in group forming is a big deal, not because of the technology itself, but because humans care so much about being in groups. We're social creatures. Almost anything we do, almost any task we take on of any size or scope or importance requires the effort of a group. And so when it becomes easier for groups to form, you don't just get more groups, you get more kinds of groups. You get people coming together and doing things that they couldn't otherwise have done. And so there are lots of examples of the book from even places where very simple sharing of the sort we're used to from YouTube or Flickr or whatever have really big ramifications. For instance, when the Indian Ocean tsunami happened the day after Christmas a couple of years ago, it affected 13 countries. It was a huge, huge area of damage, and the people on any the people in any given scene who were the likeliest to have cameras weren't photojournalists. They were tourists with camera phones. And Flickr allowed this group to come together of people who were just sharing first just pictures of the scenes of destruction, and then pressed it's just an ordinary photo sharing service, but they pressed it into service to turn it into a way to look for the missing, to identify the missing, to put up pictures and details and so forth. And that ability for ordinary citizens to take advantage of media by creating it on their own and distributing it on their own, that's a really, really fairly profound change.
You say that not only are we able to form groups more easily, but obviously that produces more kinds of groups. Are there limits to this proposition? I mean, too many groups to join, too short attention spans, fleeting relationships. I mean, where is the downside of this?
There's a couple of downsides. The one is the one you've mentioned, which is that there are more ways of forming groups, but there are not more hours in the day. And so you get into what's often called the width versus depth trade-off. You can be a casual member of a lot of groups, or you can be a deep member of a few groups, but you can't be a deep member of a lot of groups. So we're currently in an era where just the sort of the kid in the candy store aspect of being able to join all these groups, you see people running around joining lots and lots of groups on Facebook, the social networking service, or expanding their circle of friends on Facebook until it includes hundreds or even thousands of people. Plainly, those people are spreading themselves quite thinly. The bigger downside, in a way, the more complicated one, is that this new ability to form groups and for groups to acquire a kind of resilience is true even for groups we don't like, right? Al-Qaeda is famously a loosely affiliated network at this point. Its ability to function as a strong hierarchical network was interrupted by the U.S. military, but not its ability to function in this loosely coordinated way. And so we are getting more kinds of groups that are inimical to society, as well as more kinds of groups that are beneficial. And that, long-term, I think, is the really big deal.
As we form these groups, Clay, there's been this hand-wringing about the loss of social capital in American cities. Is this a new form of social capital, and is it meaningful?
I think yes and yes. In fact, Meetup, the service, one of the services I chronicle in the book, which is set up precisely to address the problem you mentioned. Scott Heifman, who's the founder of Meetup, came up with the idea for the service after reading Robert Putnam's very affecting book, Bowling Alone, on precisely the decline of social capital. And the idea behind Meetup is to get people to actually stand up from their computers and walk out into the real world and get together at bars and cafes and so forth around areas of shared interest. And Meetup has generated an enormous amount of social capital. One of the biggest and most popular Meetup groups meeting, you know, all over the U.S. is the Stay-at-Home Moms Meetup. And what that group has done is that they've essentially recreated some of the social capital from the neighborhood, you know, where you get running into other moms in the neighborhood. Now, in a sort of suburbanized, dual-income United States, that neighborhood social capital is much harder to come by. And people are now turning to these kinds of coordinating tools to reinvigorate not just online community, but real-world community as well. And that, I think, is one of the really big changes. We're living through what I'm calling the death of cyberspace, the idea that the internet is just a kind of second alternative space you go to when the real world gets too boring or too troubling. And we're starting to see, particularly among younger people, the internet being used instead as a dashboard for their real lives, right? A way of coordinating social events and a way of meeting people that they then associate with in the real world. And that, I think, particularly to the subject of cities, right? There are many ways in which that could be harnessed to reinvigorate rather than empty out urban areas.
I realize that, you know, in the beginning we all thought technology was going to make place unimportant. And clearly, as you say, technology has been used to make place in some ways more important. And yet, I also wonder if it really, in the end, will not pull from place. I mean, I may find that because I have a much wider range of friends and groups to choose from, I'm pulled from one place to another because I find the friends there much more interesting. I'm just trying to understand how you see it playing out over time in terms of technology's impact on place.
It is certainly the case that we are no longer limited to having friends and associates who are geographically near us. And I think now and for the foreseeable future, we're all going to have friends who are far away, either because we meet people online or because people we knew in high school, in college, at a job, then move away and we stay in touch with them. But I think the high watermark of that change is already in the past, right? It was really in the late 90s when the rhetoric of cyberspace was around this idea of what Francis Cairncross called the death of distance, right? The idea that you could as easily be friends with someone around the world as around the block. And that belief turned out to be an artifact of the fact that most of the people you knew in the real world simply weren't online. The big change now is in social density. For anybody under 30 who's, you know, living and working in a city at any job that pays above minimum wage, not only are they online, everyone they know is online. And at the very least, the need to find an apartment and the interest in going out with people your age means that the anchor of social life is now more geographic than it was even 5 years ago. When everybody has the internet, you don't have to choose between geography and affinity. You can actually choose to associate with people in your geographic area who also share your affinity. One of the really remarkable examples of it, one of the early examples, was the Howard Dean meetup in 2003, the thing that kicked off his campaign on a national scale, right? People wanted to have a meetup about Dean in New York City, and 300 people turned out. Now, it would in previous years have been very difficult to figure out who else living in your town was interested in thing X or Y. But Meetup actually made that really easy. The town you live in will never be as completely determinant of your social life, but the high watermark of the death of distance is, as I said, already in the past. We now are using search engines to find people near us who care about things we care about. And that change, I think, is going to be really good for cities.
You write in your book about the limits of organization, and you ask a provocative question. How do we get organization at a big scale without organization? Another word here for organization, I guess, might be bureaucracy. Will new technology help us do that?
We certainly have a lot of examples where it already has done, and that I think the big challenge for our historical area is how much can we generalize those? So you look at Wikipedia, for example, which is an enormous undertaking by any measure. I worked out with Martin Wattenberg at IBM, who studies Wikipedia. I worked out a sort of back-of-the-envelope calculation. That's 100 million hours of human thought have gone into Wikipedia. And the idea that all of that has happened without the people working for Wikipedia functioning as employees and being directed by managers who are then being directed by managers' managers and so forth, the idea that all of that work has come together without that kind of hierarchical direction is pretty astonishing. And I think the big question is how much of the value that we're seeing in the kind of purely intellectual realm can be harnessed for real-world action as well. And again, it's about taking the kind of coordination problems that are always such a hassle when you're dealing with big groups and solving those using internet tools, but then applying those solutions to real-world social problems, not just to creating a new piece of software.
Of course, everybody in my world, Clay, complains about bureaucracy. government bureaucracy.
Right.
Do you imagine, or have you seen examples, perhaps, of governments that you think are employing these new technologies in ways that really begin to reduce bureaucracy?
And something I've learned from doing some work inside the Beltway for various projects is it's easy to create new bureaucracy and very, very hard to destroy it. So the difficulty with improving government bureaucracy using these new social tools is that it's very hard to dismantle any existing piece of the civil service. One really, really kind of interesting and promising experiment is the Library of Congress, who wanted to label a bunch of pictures in their historic photo collection and have never been able to afford, you know, the librarian costs of doing such a thing. But what they realized is all of the pictures were in the public domain. If they just uploaded them to Flickr, the photo sharing service we were talking to earlier, then these treasures, which are actually the American public's, would also be accessible to people, and citizens would tag them out of interest in finding them useful. And so that's a place where a government said, we don't need to raise and then spend tax dollars to perform this service. We can actually give this stuff back directly to the public, and the public can do it on their own. The big obstacle to that kind of experimentation, frankly, is people defending their turf within the, you know, within the bureaucratic environment.
Well, and that makes sense. And I think about a city like New York, which has a mayor who many would call innovative, Michael Bloomberg. And I think about new concerns that are coming on stream, which don't necessarily sort of carry their own bureaucracy, like sustainability, where he developed a new sustainability initiative. And you know, so you don't have the old structure, the old bureaucracy in place. Have you seen him use technology to organize in new ways to eliminate the organization or the institution?
The best example of that right now is what he's done with the 311 system, where city bureaucracy presented such a crazy collection of different interfaces to the average citizen that citizens were simply paralyzed. If they saw a pothole or graffiti or a dangerous situation, or they needed to call the Taxi and Limousine Commission, whatever it was, there were hundreds of numbers, possibly thousands. And by coordinating all of that behind a single website and phone number, he's enormously simplified the interface the average citizen has to the government. Now, the much harder part, which they've worked on but have not done as well with, I have to say, is taking that inbound information and actually learning from it, creating a feedback loop so that what you see the citizens asking about can be used to sort of assess the citizens' priorities or what, you know, what areas need some kind of effort. And the problem there, frankly, is that what bureaucracies are best at is defending themselves from the people they're meant to serve. The police have probably done it most successfully with the CompStat, with the crime map. So for every success, like 311 or like CompStat, there's still a lot of work left to be done.
I want you to spend some time explaining the process of how we get from what you call sharing to cooperation to collective action. And I think collective action, obviously, is that's the jackpot.
That's really the ladder of how much work the individual has to do to become a member of the group, to participate in the group activity, right? And I don't mean for that to be a ladder of mediocre to good. In fact, there's an enormous amount of value in sharing. It's just an observation that of all the ways we have of forming groups, the big trade-off is how much does the individual have to give up to be a member of the group? So sharing is the simplest, right? Again, YouTube, Flickr, Delicious for links and tags and so forth. There are all of these examples. Really, since Napster, that's been a normal and widespread model. And sharing is quite interesting because all you have to do is agree that you'll participate in some kind of aggregate value. Yes, I'm going to upload this picture, but other people can see it as well. And that's such a simple decision, and yet it creates so much value that for a lot of people, their normal experience of social media is around these sharing sites. Collaboration is the next step up the ladder, and when you're collaborating, what you're really doing is altering your behavior to synchronize with people who are altering their behavior to synchronize with you. So if you and I, for instance, are contributing into some kind of shared project, let's say we're writing a report to figure out how to improve a sustainability effort in a city, right? We kind of have to agree on a format for the report. We kind of have to agree on a due date. We both have to be working at the same time. It takes us more effort to synchronize with one another and to synchronize with other members of the group. But we've decided it's worth it because there's a shared output. And very often, the sort of sharing communities eventually become collaborative communities because people get to know and trust one another. And so they want to take on more complicated jobs. And then collective action is the most complicated because with collective action, there aren't outcomes for individuals. The whole group benefits or not, depending on the fate of the group. So the classic example is political protest, right? All those kids that I wrote about in the book protesting the Lukashenko government in Belarus, in the former Soviet Republic. It's not like you can join one of those protests and then benefit personally. Either the Lukashenko government falls or it doesn't. And so the whole group is kind of bound together in this very tight integration. Because the only way the fate of the individuals improve is if the fate of the group improves as a whole. Collective action is the most complicated pattern because the individual has to give up the most and takes on the most risk. But collective action is really also where deep political and social leverage comes from.
And it's interesting you use the example you did. I thought it was quite interesting that you pointed out that email has become so easy. It's an ineffective tool with which to influence political decisions. As our tools become easier to use, they lose their value.
They don't lose all of their value. I mean, email creates an enormous amount of value. What they do, they lose their value in signaling to decision makers that people really care about this. You know, if you send a handwritten letter to your congressperson, someone will take notice precisely because of the effort that went into writing the letter. If you fire off an email to your congressperson or to someone else's congressperson because you're so mad and it's so easy, that email really counts for almost nothing. Almost no one pays any attention to those because they're too easy to generate. And so the art of political protest in this era is slowly becoming the art of creating hard-to-fake signals. It's a much bigger deal to turn people out into the street.
You have a chapter you call Failure for Free. Explain the value of free failures.
Everybody fails, and the classic institutional approach to failure is to say, since failure is costly, we're going to try and reduce the amount of failure we suffer. So they do two things. There's a lot of advanced planning. Is this a good idea? Let's have a lot of meetings to discuss it. And also, frankly, there's a lot of hiding of failure, right? Well, it didn't work out very well, but we don't need to talk about it. What happens on the internet in really large successful ecosystems, and I concentrate on two. I concentrate on the weblog world, and I also concentrate on the open source software world, is that instead of trying to reduce the likelihood of failure, the systems reduce the cost of failure, right? A weblog means absolutely anybody can say anything they like in public anytime they like. Now, most weblog posts don't generate any real traffic or reaction or any of the rest of it, but because there's no reason not to post something, we actually get much, much more experimentation in the weblog world than we do in print media. There's no attempt to decide in advance whether or not something's a good idea. People just do things. And as a result of getting what I call failure for free, which is to say essentially the cost of failure is so low, these systems actually progress much faster than their hierarchically managed counterparts, precisely because everybody learns much more quickly what works and what doesn't work. And if institutions did a better job of learning from their failures and also understanding that sometimes it costs less to try something than to sit around deciding whether it's a good idea or not, I think those two changes, those two things we could learn from the internet, would have a hugely positive effect.
Who do you really wish would read your book, but probably won't?
John McCain and Barack Obama. For all the internet has been used in the current presidential campaign, it's mostly been used to solicit either money or, you know, citizen media from us, from the citizens, right? So a lot of it's about either marketing the candidates or funding the candidates. But I have this feeling that going to the American public and soliciting ideas and having them make these suggestions and make and discuss these suggestions in potentially very large groups could be a hugely transforming moment in American life. And the gap between the internet as it's been used in the campaign, principally as a marketing tool, and what could happen if the internet were actually harnessed as an idea factory seems to me to be one of the really big opportunities of the political age. So I wish that the presidential candidates would read it, because I think there is so much value in going to their supporters for ideas, not just for funding and marketing. And I don't see that possibility being well tapped yet.
If John McCain or Barack Obama came to you and said, "Clay, I like your idea. What do I do now?" What would you tell them?
So you essentially have to build a system that does two things at the same time. Takes absolutely any input from anybody, anywhere, and very, very quickly sorts the good stuff from the bad stuff. Right? It's plain that if you open up a system to all ideas from anybody, you're going to get a lot of crazy stuff. You're going to get some stuff that's poorly thought out. You're going to get some stuff that's overtly racist. You're going to get some stuff from people who think the CIA put radios in the fillings of their teeth. But as with the failure for free argument, you can't try and filter that stuff in advance. What you have to do is to be able to sort after the fact the good stuff from the stuff that is going to be impractical or not worth acting on for one reason or another. So I think what I would do is a kind of propose one, rate three system. And I don't know that these are the right numbers. But just have some place where citizens could go and say, here's my idea, or here's the issue I think we should be engaging, here's some place I think the country could go. And then, before that is deposited in the system, show that person three other contributions from other citizens and say, what do you think about this? Should somebody else take a look at this, yes or no? And have them rate it yes or no. So that at the very moment of intake, what you're getting is a kind of aggregate judgment. And the good ideas, the stuff that a large number of people say, oh my goodness, that's definitely something we should act on. And, you know, it would all be entered into the system, but it would very quickly flag the good stuff and also potentially very quickly flag the terrible stuff. And then turn it over in a Wikipedia-style environment to much longer-term, much more thoughtful, much better annotated discussion. That kind of two-step, right? Hugely wide intake valve, a kind of very simple rating system to float interesting stuff to the top, and then a way of acting in a deliberative way on the interesting ideas. That's what I'd advocate building.
Clay, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. I love your book.
Not at all. Thank you, Carol. It's lovely, lovely for you to invite me. I'm really pleased to be here.
Clay Shirky is the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. He joined us from his office in New York City. Finally, Walker Smith has many titles, PhD, trend spotter, and City Views commentator. But this week, he tells us he's also been known as a Butterfingers.
I drop things all the time. Always have, still do. Two nights ago, what I dropped was one of those really nice sommelier-style wine glasses, and I dropped it in the sink while rinsing it out, and the next thing I knew, it was in splinters all over the place. About every other day, I drop an aspirin tablet on the bathroom floor as I fumble to get one out without spilling the entire container. I drop my car keys once a month or so, standing by my car in the airport parking lot after arriving home from a business trip. I drop socks, getting them out of the drawer. I drop magazines trying to pick one up to scan the table of contents. I have watched spill crumbs and pieces of food disappear into every inaccessible crevice of my car, usually, it seems, those in which two fingers will simply not fit. But the worst thing I ever dropped and lost was my wedding ring. When Joy and I got married, we started from scratch with no scratch to speak of. I had no money to buy her an engagement ring, much less a wedding ring, so she decided to wear her late father's wedding ring, and we went out and bought a thin, inexpensive gold band for me. I wore it for over two decades, over which time it acquired a lot of sentimental value. But on a Grand Canyon River trip, I awoke one morning after a long, hot hike the day before with swollen hands and feet. I pried my wedding ring off my ring finger and put it on my little finger. After breakfast, I noticed the swelling in my hands and feet had subsided, and as I was packing my gear, I realized that the ring was not on my finger anymore. I scoured the campsite, then suddenly realized that it had probably fallen off in the dishwashing bucket where I had lent a hand after breakfast. But it was too late. At that very moment, a river guide was throwing the dirty dishwater into the Colorado. My wedding ring went with it. I liked the Grand Canyon so much that I was able to reconcile the loss of my ring with the grandeur of the place where I lost it. Joy was less than impressed, however, especially when several years later I lost the replacement ring we bought and engraved for me to wear when we renewed our vows. At this point, I became the one wearing her father's wedding ring until a year later, when one of the yard crew knocked on our door one fall afternoon and, in silence because he spoke no English, held out a bent and severely nicked gold band that he had just found lying in our driveway. Obviously, we had driven over it dozens of times, but at least it was found. I suppose I am an incurable fumbler, doomed to many more years of prying dropped items from hidden crannies. It's my fate, after all, so I'll just take it and run with it, unless, of course, I drop that ball, too. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. That's all for this week's show, but there's more Smart City if you go to our website, smartcityradio.com, where you can listen to archive shows, subscribe to our podcast, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or sending email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our vacationing producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.